Good morning. So, last time we talked about encoding and decoding YID6, rather mechanical procedure. We're given our tables of what the encoding was. We looked at our first byte, where conveniently the top four bits told us which row of the table to look at, and could go in either direction, either encoding some written assembly or taking some machine code and converting it instruction by instruction back into equivalent assembly. Then we started talking about how we build hardware, how, you know, now that we know what our machine code looks like, you know, how to deal with it by hand, how are we going to make hardware that actually interprets those instructions? We started by talking about the notion of like where we're moving values between these components. So we have these wires. Typically, we have these bundles of wires that hold a multi-bit value. And we connect these to combinatorial logic, where we put in an input. And after some short delay, when it does some computation on the input, computes, for our purposes, any function of that input. Then we talked about, well, that's not enough to do like what our programs do of doing things which have multiple steps. Like it wasn't right enough for a counter because we have to have separated steps. We can't just have a circuit that feeds back into itself without doing something special, because otherwise we get these sort of unstable results while things are changing. So our solution for that was this notion of clocked logic, that we had things like registers, which took a clock signal, and that clock signal said when they go from one step to the next. And so before that clock signal, they let things stabilize, and then we'd have a clock signal, and we move on to the next step, in the case of registers, reading the value from just before the rising edge of the clock and starting to output that for the next entire cycle of the clock. Talked about some other components we'll use to build our processor. So we had memories and our register file. So our memories contained our contents of memory. So we had a separate data and instruction memory. In our processor, these will actually access the same memory. We'll talk about how that could possibly work much later in the semester when we talk about caches. And we also had the register file, which held the registers that you're familiar with in assembly. We also saw that we had some extra registers that don't show up in assembly, like the program counter was a register in our simple processor designs that wasn't in the register file. And then we started building simple processors. And one important thing we needed to do once we got beyond the very simplest of our processors was we needed to do multiple things depending on what type of instruction we had. So we needed some sort of component that let us make a decision. And that component was a MUX. So a MUX took in this selector input and chose between each of its other inputs what output to do. So it was basically a switch with this selector signal saying what option do we take for the switch. And we could use that, for example, to decide sometimes I'm going to choose my next instruction by using, say, the value from the instruction memory for a jump. Sometimes I'm just going to add to the PC, and we could make the decision between those two and make our processor which executed nops and jumps. Okay. So any questions before I move on from yesterday and go into slightly more complicated processors? Okay, so let's move on to, now that we know how to build processors which can execute more than one instruction, let's do that with a slightly larger set of instructions. So here I have all the move to register instructions. So you can think that these are all going to have something in common where they're all writing into a register. They're all going to take advantage of that. And they have different values being written. So what we can think is that, if you remember that we use MUXes to make a decision, the big decision we're going to make here is going to be what value do I want to write into the register, so we're going to have a MUX for that. So let's start building this up. And there's multiple ways you can do this. So we're going to have assignments where we have you make a processor. And you know, one thing you could do is you could just look at all the instructions and say, okay, I need a mux for the value I'm putting into the register, and you could figure that all out all in advance. The procedure I prefer to take is to go instruction by instruction. So rather than figuring out in advance, yeah, I'm going to need a mux to decide what goes into the register value to write, I'm going to say, I'm just going to first start with the processor that does the first instruction. I'm going to just keep adding things. And whenever I have a conflict, I'm going to say, oh, I need a mux to decide which thing to do. So I'm going to start by saying, okay, we need a processor that does RR move queue. I'm just going to implement that. I have my components that I'll need eventually, my data memory, which I won't need yet, my register file, my instruction memory, my PC. And I'm going to start by just building a processor that only does RR move queue. So we know we need to fetch from the instruction memory. In fact, this is going to happen for every single instruction. And we need to split out the parts of the instruction. In particular, we need to extract RA and RB from the big value our instruction memory is giving us. And I know I'm going to need to read from RA and write to RB. So I should attach RA to one of the sources here and RB to one of the destinations. So I'll do some version of that here. Just to keep things simpler for later, I also attach something to source B, but we didn't have to do that yet. So I attach source A, so I'm reading from RA, and I'm writing to RB. And I know the value I want to write to RB, which needs to go into this input in the register file, is going to be what we're reading from source A. So I'm just going to connect that. Okay, so that's my processor for RR move queue, except that I haven't dealt with updating the PC. If we wanted to update the PC for this, right now it would be, we'd have a plus two, and we send that back around. Okay. Questions on what I have so far? And as I mentioned in the beginning, we're going to want to make a decision. And the first thing we'll come up with is that, okay, my next thing I want is IR move queue. And we say, what do we need for IR move queue? Well, we're going to take this value here, so some output of split, and we want to write that to RB. So it's being written to the same place as IR move queue, so that's the same. I want to hook up RB to destination E, but we're writing the value we're going to get from split into here. And I can't connect two things to register file without some sort of switch to decide, so I'm going to add a mux in front of that to decide which of those things I do. And as my second input to the mux, I'm going to take the V from the instruction and have that be an option. And when I add this mux, I need some logic to decide which option does the mux take, and that's going to use what we'll call the opcode, this first part of the instruction. So it's going to convert those 2, 3, or 5 into whatever index we need to make the mux act appropriately, to choose the first line for RR move queue and the second line for IR move queue. So any questions so far? So why is it plus two? I wrote that for RR move queue. And for RR move queue, we have 1, 2 bytes in the instruction. But that's not actually what we want for IR move queue, is it? So you probably were asking because you noticed that. So it turns out we're going to need a mux here because we want to do plus two or plus 10. And now we need a mux to decide which one we'll do, and I'll have that drawn out later. But yes, so you notice that in only looking at what the instruction computes, I kind of glossed over the next PC. We need plus 10 because IR move queue uses 2 bytes plus 8 bytes of value V that we need to skip over to get to the next instruction. For our remove queue, we only have 2 bytes to skip over. In both cases, we'll read a full 10 bytes from the instruction memory. It's just that for our remove queue, that part that I've shaded in red, we won't actually do anything useful with. We'll have the immediate, for our remove queue, this immediate wire is going to contain the value that's in this red part here, but we're not going to use it because the MUX won't select it. Okay, so how about our next instruction? So our next instruction is MRMOVEQ DRB to RA. DRB, this is a memory location. So for this, we need to take D, which is the same thing as V as far as where we're going to get it. It's that part of the instruction. So this wire I've labeled immediate contains D if we're executing an MRMOVEQ. And we need to add it to the value of RB and use that to access memory. So we're going to take RB plus the value in RB plus D. So we need an adder and send that into the address input of data memory. And we know the way data memory works is when we send in that value, shortly thereafter, we'll get out the value that we want to send to store into our register file. So something rather subtle here that our textbook did in this instruction set that you might complain about is it really RB and not RA? So you might be tempted to say, we're reading a value from the register file, we're just going to take that and our immediate, add them together and put that into the address, and that is not right because this is the value of RA. And not RB. So that is not something, that's not how we're going to do this. So we're going to have to take in the value of RB. So this signal here is going to be RB and send it into source B, get it out of source B, and that's what we're going to end up adding. And the instruction stores into RA, not RB, even though you might think it made more sense to store in RB, which means that we want to connect RA into destination E, which means we now need a MUX here. Because sometimes for the first two instructions we store into RB, the second one we store into RA. So that ends up looking like this. So we have a MUX for our destination register, because sometimes it's RA, sometimes it's RB, and we have our adder to produce our address. And in this case, we always access memory, but we're saying, well, reading memory is going to be harmless, we hope, so we don't bother controlling where that happens. Or if reading memory isn't harmless, we remember that we have a read enable signal that we can control that I'm just not drawing. And the final thing I don't have drawn out on my slides, which I mentioned earlier, is we need our logic to actually increment the PC, which I drew earlier, which is that sometimes we add 2 to the PC for our remove queue. Sometimes we add 10, and that works for both of the other instructions, so I only need a MUX with 2 entries for that. So any questions on what I've drawn here? Yeah. So destination E. So remember that our register file inputs come in pairs. And for the writing, the pair is the register number to write. So like 0 for REX, 8 for R8, and so on. And that's what destination E is paired with this next value here. And for the first two instructions, we want to write to RB, which is this part of the instruction, these 4 bits that tells us the number of the register. So it will be 8 if it's like a move into R8. And for MR move Q, we want to write into RA. Because of what's written in the table, like it's just a choice our textbook authors made. And we'll talk later a little about why they do that. You can think about it as a hint. Probably looking at this subset of instructions won't tell you why they did it. And so in that case, we do RA. And in all cases, we want to have the corresponding value input be whatever value we're writing to the register file. Other questions? Okay. So let's add one more instruction to this. So I have all the types of unconditional moves except the ones which move into memory instead of into a register. So let's add that. So I'm just adding our register to memory move instruction. So I'm just going to add that to my processor. And this is the way I recommend working. It's just like build some subset of the instructions and just add them on following our same design philosophy. And whenever you have some sort of conflict, we might need to add a mux. Or if you already have a mux there, you might need to just add a line to the mux, make it a bigger mux. So here, we have our RM move Q instruction, and what it wants to do is it's going to take RA, so we need to read RA. Happily, we already do that, so I don't need anything extra for that. This logic already reads from RA because we have source A we know is going to be, turns out, that this line is RA and this line is RB, that is these 4 bits of the instruction. Okay, and we want to take that value and send it to memory. We're going to use the data memory to do all our writes. That's the convention we've chosen. So we need to take this value from RA, and we need to send it over to this data input of our memory. So it can be written, assuming we set the write enable signal. So I mentioned the write enable signal. So for the RM move Q instruction, we want to write to memory, and all the other instructions better not write to memory, because otherwise we're randomly scribbling whatever values in RA in memory, and that would be very confusing if your register to register move changed memory in some location. So we're going to have a write enable signal here that we're going to need to set. Is there anything else I need? Does everything else look fine for this instruction? So what are the other things this instruction does besides writing to memory? And as a hint, think of the things all instructions do. If you remember in our textbook, you may have read about stages. So you can think about what were those stages. Is there anyone we haven't accounted for? So one thing that, yes? So the write back. So what's going to happen in the write back stage with what I've drawn here? Yeah, so we might write something to a register. If we look at our register file hookups, our destination E, our register number to write, it's hooked up to a mux which can either give us RA or RB. And those are both real register numbers for the RMoveQ instruction, which means that when we're setting up the convert opcode circuit that controls that mux, we have a choice of either writing a value to RA or RB. And we know that we shouldn't change any registers in this instruction, because it doesn't do that, anything in the register file. So a question is, can we get this to be safe, to have the right effect with either of those choices? So as a starting point, so which of RA and RB should we choose, or are none of them a good option? That's the first question. Like, you're implementing this instruction, we need to decide for an RMoveQ, what should destination E become? Someone? Yeah.
Right? Right, like RA into RA or RB.
Okay, so one option is we could try to write RA into RA or RB into RB. And with what I've drawn here, one thing we could do is we could say, okay, we're going to write, take RA, that's what we're going to say the register we're writing into, and we could take the value of RA, which we conveniently have sitting on this wire here, and send that as the value to write. So that would be a valid choice to make. Now that's rather confusing, to have instructions that randomly read a register only to write back the same value. So typically we're going to use a different solution, which is to add an extra line input to the mux to indicate don't write to anything. And if you remember how our register file works, the number 15 said don't write to anything, so we'll just add that extra input, which is a simpler solution than writing RH into RA. And when we do that, we don't care what this mux does, because whatever value it sends to the register file isn't going to do anything. We're going to not write anything when that rising edge of the clock comes. The other thing we need to consider besides the write-back stage was the PC update. But fortunately, we can do that. So for PC update, we take R plus 10. And that's how we compute our next PC for this instruction. So that's already there. We don't need to add anything. Okay, so any questions here? Yeah?
Could we have used the write enable on the register file instead of...
So the question is, could we have used the write enable on the register file? So our textbook chose a particular register file design. And their design decision was that we would have, instead of having a write enable signal, we'd use the special register number 15. Indeed, we could have had a different register file design that was given to us, where instead of a register number 15, we had a separate write enable signal, in which case we would have used that. Oh, and the other thing I mentioned earlier is we need to have this write enable signal here, because we know we don't want all the instructions to write to it. And I've just labeled it as from convert opcode, because as you can see, if I draw all the wires here, this quickly becomes very messy. So any questions on any part of processor I have here? Okay, so this is all our move instructions. And when you run in our textbook liked approaching this from the viewpoint of stages. And we'll talk more about stages later. I think it's worth pointing out where are each of the stages on this circuit diagram of a processor. And they're not really, if we use our textbook stages, quite where you expect things to be divided up. So I've drawn here where each of the stages are. So we have our fetch stage, which includes our computing the address of the next instruction, and actually fetching the current instruction. Have our decode stage, which you would think would be where the convert opcode thing is, but that's not our textbook's definition of what the decode stage does. Instead, it's where we actually read from the register file. We have our execute stage, which is where we use the ALU. So notice that in these move instructions, the execute stage is where we do the work of computing memory addresses. And we also have our memory stage, which is where we access data memory. That one at least makes sense. And we have our write back stage, which is where we do the work related to accessing the register file to write registers. And finally, we have our PC update stage, which is where we update the PC. I don't have anything here because we aren't really making a choice once we know where the next instruction is, because we don't have anything like a conditional jump involved in this this processor supporting that. So these are the stages our textbook talks about. And something that's worth noting is that right now, these stages look like, you know, just a way of dividing up the processor, which doesn't necessarily indicate that, you know, things happen in any particular order. They're more of a way of organizing our processor. Later on, we'll have a reason why our textbook chose to divide things up this way, because it's a good question of why would you want to include the computing the address of the next instruction in fetch, and so on, and why would you want these stages? We'll have a very good reason for that later on when we talk about something called pipelining, which is the real reason our textbook chose these particular stages. But for now, in our processor, these are just a conceptual division of the instruction. Most importantly, they don't tell you when things happen. That the memory stage might be doing work while the write back stage is doing work, for example. Like, they're not actually independent of each other necessarily. They're not like one step then another right now, because it's one big circuit, and remember how our components work. Our register file does reads whenever it gets values, and it does writes at the rising edge of the clock. Our memory does reads whenever it gets values and does writes at the rising edge of the clock. And that's what determines the timing, not these stages, because these stages are just me dividing up this circuit into pieces. Now, for this part of the class, before we've done doing pipelining, the main advantage of the stages is that it might make it easier for you to design your processor. So what our textbook suggests is let's write down what happens for each instruction in each stage and just build basically the piece of hardware we need for each stage. So their idea is that rather than looking at the instruction as a whole, you're just going to say only look at what happens in, say, write back. And you'll say, okay, we have an input, which is going to come from memory or execute, and that's all I need to care about. I don't need to care about how that's made. And I'm just making the hardware to like make a decision between them. Like, that's the advantage of stages at this point, is that maybe it makes it easier to design the processor because you work on one stage at a time, you go through all the instructions you care about for that stage, and move on to the next, rather than having to look at the whole processor for all our instructions. So those are our stages. And at this point, yes, there's a conceptual division of the instruction. These are the operations in them. And yes, I'll point out the two big things which are not intuitive here, which is that the fetch stage includes computing the length of the instruction to find the next instruction. And the decode stage is where we read the register file. And these are just sort of bad, well, there's a reason we compute the length of the instruction in the fetch stage, which we'll see later on when we talk about pipelining, why our textbook authors put that in there. And for the decode stage, this is just a bad naming convention that, you know, is mostly historical. It's not mostly our textbook authors' fault. It's people before them. Okay. So any questions about these stages? Yeah.
You said that they're not particularly in order. So does that mean that
So the question is, they're not particularly in order. So there is an ordering of things that happen. So for example, you obviously can't do the register read before you fetch the instruction because you don't know what register to read. And write back is going to have some similar constraints for most instructions. But the constraints are based on what the circuit looks like, not name the stages inherently. So for example, for you mentioned like reading registers and write back, for IR move Q, like that doesn't determine, like there's no actual dependency. So the ordering, if there's an ordering constraint, it's going to be determined by something else. And that goes to my next question. So we have these stages. So let's consider if we're implementing a push queue instruction, which we probably won't have you do, but textbook talks about implementing this. When would things happen, given you know our given the type of the processor design I'm showing here? So this is our processor design. And think about if we're using this style of design and going to add a push queue instruction with our single cycle processor design, when do these events happen? We have, for push queue, we need to read the instruction. So we need to read that we have a push instruction that pushes into RAX, register number 0. We need to, at some point, change memory to push the value that we read from RAX. We need to, at some point, change RSP. And we need to, at some point, change the program counter. So when do these things actually happen in this style of circuit design? I'll give you a minute. You can talk with your neighbor to see if you agree. Who needs more time? Okay. Okay, so who thinks A? B? Okay, C? D? E? And F? Okay, so we have somewhat of a split. And this is a tricky question, which is why I'm asking it. And the tricky part is that it looks like it's going to be a question about what things in what stage. And that's not what it's a question about. It is a question about two things. So one thing is that if you remember, our processor is a single cycle. That this design was a single cycle, meaning one instruction per cycle. So if we're extending that to push Q, it's still going to execute in one cycle. And given that, it's really a question about how do registers, register files, and memory work. It's not actually a question about stages. And the way our memories work is that reading memory or registers happens during the cycle. So we have our clock signal, we have a rising edge, this, and this time is one instruction. And when the instruction starts, because the PC changed, the reads happen at some point in here. And all our writes happen at the rising edge of the clock. So in our one instruction time, they all happen at this rising edge here. This is our writes. And they're all triggered by that same rising edge. So they all happen at essentially the same time, almost the same time. They're all triggered by this one global clock signal. And because it's one cycle for the instruction, that's the same rising edge for all of these events. Because our processor design executes one instruction per cycle. So this is contrary to, you know, what you'd reasonably think by reading our textbook carefully listing these stages in always the order I have written at the top of this slide. You know, telling you those are the parts of the instruction, you would think, yeah, of course, that's how you fetch, you do code, you do execute. But that's not how our hardware works as far as when things actually get updated. So the correct answer for this processor design is B. We could imagine other processor designs, and we'll in fact have one later in the semester, where we actually do the stages in order. And in that case, you would actually care about what stage things are in, and you say this is fetch, this is memory, this is write back, and this is, well, it's going to be complicated. But right now you think it's PC update. We're going to change that when we get to making our processor, which actually doesn't do everything in one cycle. But for one cycle, it doesn't matter what stages things are in as far as when things happen. What matters is, you know, if it's a write, it has to happen at that rising edge. If it's a read, you just have to say, when do we have the values available to read? So if I added, read from the register file, well, then you know that happens after we read the instruction because we need to know what to read from the register file. Okay, so any questions about what I'm showing here? Okay. That's about our stages. And before I move on, so one last thing that we come across. Why do you think they decided to have MRMoveQ be the write to RA instead of RB? Anyone have a Like, what were textbook authors thinking when they designed Y86 this way?
ALU,
sorry?
Yeah. Like addition adds into A, right? The ALU is also.
Okay. So you're saying it might make the ALU simpler?
Addition and the address change more consistent.
Okay. It makes the address computations more consistent. And you can see that here, that both M remove Q and R remove Q compute the same address. And we don't have to have a mux over here to decide what two values to add. So that's why their textbook authors made that weird decision that you saw M remove Q writes to RA instead of RB, is they said, well, I'm gonna make choosing the register to write to more complicated in order to make the other part a little simpler when you're implementing all the instructions together. There's also some other things going on, which is, that if you look at all the Y86 instructions, everything which reads a value from memory and writes it to a register always writes to RA. And they in fact use the other write port of the register file for that, which is not what I did in my version of the processor. Okay, so any questions about that? And you can see this is a place where, you know, they were designing this instruction set with a particular hardware design in mind when they made that choice of like what register to write to. Okay, so our next topic is going to be about describing hardware in the way we'll actually use for assignments. So we could like have you draw pictures, and you could like build hardware that way. And there are commercial tools for that. So there are commercial tools which are called schematic capture tools. They're called schematic capture because you make a schematic and the tool captures that and lets you turn that into possibly actual hardware. But they're not commonly used for building whole processors. Typically, when you're building whole processors, the dealing with a graphical tool for the sorts of things you want to do is awkward, like how do you do version control? If you want to move things slightly, that, you know, what's the UI look for that look like? So instead, there will be a programming language for hardware. So we'll have a text-based representation. So for my slides, I'll often draw pictures like this, but that's not what we're gonna have you build, and that's not what people do in practice when they're making processors most of the time. So they have some typically text-based representation of the circuit. But like our pictures, we'll abstract away details. So you can think of this as a programming language for hardware, and it will let you have details which are hidden, like how to build arithmetic operations from gates. Maybe, you know, there's basically a built-in library, which is you have a plus operation and it's gonna, the programming language will have a compiler of sorts, which will compile that into here are the gates to implement the plus. And other things like would happen, like registers and memories. You'll just say, I have these registers and use them. And the programming language will know how to compile that down to an actual description of here are the registers you need to build, here's what they look like, and so on. And similarly, building muxes. So we're not going to deal with how do you actually make a mux. We're just going to say, I want a mux that makes this decision. And the programming language will handle that. And you can think of this programming language, you know, as converting our text-based description into basically a list of here's how you put transistors or whatever our basic components are together that someone else can follow to actually build a processor. So this is the sort of programming language we'll be using. I'm afraid our version is, you know, built for this course. It's based on a language in our textbook, but not the same. So it doesn't actually have an implementation that compiles to hardware, but it's very close to things which do. It does omit some things we would need to like specify what the hardware would look like, just to keep things simpler, because this is not that much of a hardware class. So questions on this notion of our programming languages for hardware? So our tool, which is built for this course, is something called HTLRS. It's based on the textbook's HTL, but it's more flexible. It's not superbly more flexible. There's a real built-in assumption you're making a processor, and not just a processor, but a x86 processor. So unlike like a real commercial tool would let you build all sorts of circuits, this only lets you build x86 processors pretty much. But that means that some things are simpler, things that you would have to specify. And it also has sort of debugging output that's designed to show you like what the instructions are, assuming they're x86, rather than you having to like decode machine code to figure out what's going on. So let's go over what this is going to look like with our simple example of the simplest CPU I can think of, a CPU that is even simpler than the examples I showed you earlier of like our add CPU. And that's going to be a CPU which only runs the NAP instruction. So we have one instruction, NAP, that's the only one we're going to support. So here's my processor as a picture from the NAP instruction. I take my program counter, I add one to it, and that's my next instruction, because I know all my instructions are NOPs. And I fetch that instruction, but I don't actually care what the instruction is, because I assume everything's a NOP. And you might say, well, gosh, if you're doing that, you might as well get rid of the instruction memory. And that seems like a good idea. One of the things about our HTLRS, assuming you're building a processor, is that you have to use the instruction memory. So fetching from the instruction memory is mandatory, even in a case like this where we don't care. Yes? So the question is, in a real processor, would this be on the CPU? So the thing we're calling an instruction memory would be on the CPU. It would be something other than the component we're calling a memory. It would be a cache, which we'll talk about later in the semester. That's really what the instruction memory represents. But as far as we're concerned, the instruction memory and the data memory are just access to that big global memory, and we'll talk later on about how that actually works. So there's some components we need here. So one thing we need, most importantly, is this register to store the program counter. So we need to declare that. We need to say, I need a register for my program counter. And this is an example of a way we can declare it. So I have this register statement, and then I have two letters, and these two letters are going to be important. And then I have a list of registers. And in this case, my list of registers is one register on it. And I've named that register the PC. And I specified that the register is 64 bits long and has an initial value of 0. So we need an initial value because our tool is going to do a simulation. And when we start that, before anything happens, we need to set up all the registers with values. So you have to specify what those values are. After we start, of course, the value is going to be based on what the input to the register is. But we need that initial value so we can start simulating things. And you might say, OK, what is this P and F? So these are going to be two letters we're going to use to refer to the two sides of our register. The first one, which is, represents the input side, is always lowercase. And the second one, which represents the output side, is always uppercase, and always a single letter. So our P represents this input signal, and the F represents this output signal. And we can use that as a prefix to name that signal. And we're going to have names for our various signals, which we'll call wires, even though they're actually bundles of wires. So we'll have a name for this signal here and a name for this signal here. And we want to connect them together. So let's say we want to do this. So I'm going to say I have this signal, which remember is the big F signal. And I'm saying I'm going to add one to that, and I can just write the expression. And part of having an abstraction is we're going to assume that our tool is going to figure out how to turn that into gates that actually add one. And I say that this value I computed here that comes out of here should be connected to the input to the register, which is named with the lowercase p. And that's how I specify that connection. So questions so far? Yeah.
So by using the underscore, HCL and LRS will know that P is referring to it.
So by using the underscore, by using P underscore, we know it's everything starting with P underscore is going to be the inputs to one of these. Everything starting with capital F underscore is going to be the outputs of one of these. So you can think of this as declaring a bunch of, you know, it declares P underscore the APC and capital F underscore the APC, kind of like variables. Other questions? Okay. So the other thing we need is we need to hook up our instruction memory. I mentioned that using the instruction memory is mandatory because that's because we're assuming you're always building a processor, so even though it doesn't make much sense in this case, we need to hook something up to it. And there's a built-in wire, built-in signal you need to connect up. That's the input to the instruction memory, and it's called lowercase pc. I know that's kind of confusing with the PC register. This is the name our textbook chose. We're just being consistent with the textbook. But you can think of it as the PC, it's the current instruction we're running because that's what we're fetching from the instruction memory. So we've set the PC input to be equal to the value of this register. So we've set connected the output signal of the register both to doing the addition and to our instruction memory. And there's this output signal, which is called I10 bytes. Instruction and 10 bytes to remind you that it's 10 bytes of stuff, even if you don't care about all 10 of those bytes. But we're not going to use that, so we're just not going to mention it. But it exists because we set the PC. So questions so far? So there's one more component that we're required to use. And this is because of how our HCL tool is going to simulate your processor. We need to run it cycle by cycle, and we need to know when to stop, or whether to stop. So there's a special component which our textbook calls the stat register, and there are constants you can put in. This capital stat AOK is just a constant that's defined in some built-in code. If you go to the course website when it's up and the server room is not losing HVAC, or if that doesn't happen, I'll find some other solution. You'll find a list of all the constants that are defined and what their values are. But it's a we have a constant stat AOK that we feed to this, and this tells our simulation, so every cycle our simulation checks this to see whether we want to keep going. So you put AOK, it says keep going, keep simulating more and more cycles. If you put halt, it will say stop. And this is how we implement the halt instruction and make her do the right thing in our simulator. In real hardware, you'd have this sort of functionality where you could shut things down, but it's a lot more complicated, like, because you need to interface with something which like cuts power, which we obviously, you know, aren't going to simulate that fully. Okay. So questions about what I have here? Okay. So this is my process here, and we can actually do that. So next week you're going to have a lab which is using this, and the following homework is doing more. And to start out, you're going to download our HCLRS distribution. You'll unpack it. You'll get something like this, but without the .NOT files in it. And you'll run make, which will build a bunch of things, and then you'll have an HCLRS tool, and so HCLRS, which is our command line tool, which is our interpreter, and you'll have the ability to run HCL programs. So here's our NOP CPU. I just have a text file which contains exactly what I showed on the slide, and we want to run it with HCLRS, but it turns out that this doesn't work because we need to specify what it says is a YO file. So remember that the instruction memory is mandatory, and we need to know what's in the instruction memory. So we need to have a program to run, even for this case where we aren't going to really care what's in the program very much. And that program is going to be in a .yo file. So here is the source code for a .yo file I'm going to run. So it's a program with a bunch of NOPs. Okay? So, and you convert that from this assembly file to a .yo file, which is going to be our executable format for this processor. So let's do that. And there's two ways of doing that. So one thing we can do, I'll remove the file we generated, is that after you type make, there's going to be a file called YAS, YAssembler, YAD6 assembler, in tools. So tools YAS, nops.ys, and that will produce a nops.yo. Another option, if you didn't want to do that, is you can use make nops.yo, and it will look for the corresponding .ys file and run tools YAS for you. After we do that, we get this .yo file, which we can actually run. So let's look at the .yo file. So unlike executables, it has everything in text, so you can actually figure out what's going on. And our simulator will load this. And what this says is it's going to load 10 into address 0 in memory, 10 into address 1, and so on. And the .yo file also has the assembly, but our simulator doesn't look at that. It doesn't care what's there. It only looks at the actual hexadecimal part. So now that we have a .yo file, we can run it on our NOP CPU. So we have our NOP CPU. We can run there. So let's do that. Sure, that's probably what you were expecting. Maybe. So it doesn't finish. It times out after 999 cycles. And if you think about it, that makes sense because, well, yes, we got past the end of our memory here, but the PC kept incrementing. It ended up at hex 270E and we kept going. There was nothing to stop it because we didn't actually set up our simulator to halt. So let's talk about what's in this output here. So you can see that there's a bunch of information in the output, which might be useful later on. And the most obvious thing that keeps changing is that we have this value of the P PC register. So you can see we have our register, and we have the value of that register every cycle, so you can read that out. We also have all the values in memory. We only show the values which aren't the default value, which if it wasn't specified in the program or written to, it's zeros. So everything that's missing here is zeros, and this is saying address 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 are 10. Everything else must be zeros. We also have the values of all the registers, which we would access through the register file, which I'll talk about later. So that's our. So we found that this processor, it kept incrementing the PC. So what can we do to? Other thing I should note, yes, is that if you look at the output, we also printed out every instruction we loaded. So you look over here, you see that it printed out the PC, that's the input to the instruction memory, was set to 0x270E, and we print out the disassembly of the value that was loaded, just to help you debug. Just because we print out the correct disassembly doesn't mean your processor implements the instruction correctly, as you can see here, where this processor is certainly not halting. So let's think about what we would need to do in order to have this halt. So we're going to want a CPU that looks more like this, where we take the opcode out of the instruction memory output, and we use that to make a decision, and we're going to decide between, in this case, three values. So we have AOK is for keep going, we have halt, which is for stop, halt, and we have this INS, and that stands for invalid instruction. So that's going to act like halt, but it's going to print an error from our simulator instead of saying it terminated normally. So the only difference is just the message we get from the simulator to help us know what happened. And to do this, we need a MUX. So how do we implement a MUX? And we're going to have a special syntax for this that our book calls a case expression, and we're going to implement the same syntax. So the case expressions have an open square brace and a closed square brace, and they have a list of conditions followed by a colon and the values corresponding to that condition. The conditions are evaluated as if in order. So to evaluate this, to figure out what result is connected to, we're going to say, is x equal to 5? If so, then 1. Otherwise, if x is 0 or 6, then we're going to give 2. Otherwise, if x is greater than 2, we're going to give 3. And if all those fail, we're going to give 4. 1 is true, 0 is false. So a way you can think about this, if x is 5, first condition matches, we're done. If x is 6, first condition doesn't match, so we move on. Second condition does, we get 2. If x is 3, first condition doesn't match, second condition doesn't match, third condition does match, we get 3. If x is 4, same thing happens. If x is 1, we get 4. First condition doesn't match, second doesn't, third doesn't, fourth does. Okay, so any questions about how this works? And we'll see later on when we do pipelining that there's a reason our textbook authors designed the syntax this way, because it turns out that this evaluated in order is going to be really handy. As something that we'll do that the textbook doesn't require, we require all your case expressions, your MUXs, to have a default case, to have something like this at the end. That is mandatory, and this is because we have found that it makes people's HCL code way less error-prone. Because a big problem is forgetting a case and something has to happen. So we just require you to always have something there, even if you don't think it will ever happen. So the next thing we need is we need this extract opcode operation. And for that, we take our instruction memory output, which remember that was called i10 bytes, so it's probably 10 bytes. And we need to somehow turn that into the opcode to test against, which is going to be our probably the top 4 bits, which determine what row we were in, which we'd use to see if it was a NOP or a HALT. And we saw earlier that our wires or signals usually represented things that kind of look like integers. And this is in fact how things are going to work, that they're always integers of a certain width. So our 10 byte value is an 80 bit integer, just like our PC was a 64 bit integer that we could add 1 to. But now we need to do an operation of extracting particular bits. And there's in fact going to be a special support for that in HCLRS. And that's going to be this syntax. That given a value, a signal, we can say I want bits 2 through 9, 2 inclusive of 2, exclusive of 9, and I can say it with that syntax and get another signal of a smaller size. And for this, the least significant bit is 0. And that's how we number the bits. I have to tell you that because we have never otherwise had an occasion to number bits. In memory, you know, you have a byte, who knows how the bits are numbered. There's no way of knowing. Even with the shift operations, like, you decide which direction you shift, and that's how you decide how you're numbering them. So here we find out a reason to number the bits. So let's talk about what bits do we actually want to extract the opcode. So the value from the instruction memory is an i10 bytes. It's an 80-bit integer, and it's read from memory as if it's a little endian 80-bit integer. So that means the first byte is the least significant byte, which means that bit 0 is the least significant bit of that first byte of the instruction. Okay, so let's look at a particular instruction. Let's say push Q RBX. So push is A, and it has one register number. I'm using this instruction just because it has one thing to fill in. So it's relatively simple and short. So the first byte of this instruction, so if it's an address X in memory as a byte contains AF. That's the text value. And the second byte of the instruction contains 2F. And this means that if we consider it as little endian, we take this first byte, and that's the least significant byte of a little endian value, and we take the next byte, and that's the second least significant byte, which means if we interpret this as a 16-bit little endian number, we get 2FAF. The least significant bit is here, what we'll call bit 0, and the most significant bit is here, which means our opcode, our 4 bits which tell us what type of instruction it is not bit 0, but it's going to be bits 5 through 8. Which is usually not what people guess. So, questions about this so far? I'm going to try to spend a bunch of time on this because it confuses people, and I don't want that to happen as much as possible. Okay, so that's what our instruction looks like, and well, we're reading 10 bytes from memory, so we're actually going to have more values over here from the rest of memory. But we're not going to look at them for push, but for other instructions we will. So the reason this confuses people is because it doesn't square well with this picture. And a way you can think of it is that the way we're used to writing numbers in English, we have the least significant part rightmost, and that's exactly the opposite of what we're doing here. Is that the least significant part of the number are on the left part of this picture. So maybe it would correspond better if we had 0, 1, 2, and wrote halt, then knop, then R move Q, and so on, if we wrote the table like that, but then that would probably be harder to read for like manually encoding and decoding the instructions. But having this sort of reversed way of writing the table would correspond better to how the bit numbering works in HCL. That we're gonna have, you know, if we think of halt, knop, that we're gonna take bits 4 through 8 are this opcode part, which is what I have highlighted in blue there, the most significant 4 bits of the first byte. But because we drew this picture not to help you figure out the bit numberings, but to let you encode quickly by hand, we chose this other way of ordering the bits as far as how they're written down. But the way I would figure it out is byte 0 comes first in this picture, and what's the most significant part of the byte is 4, it's the highest numbered bits for HCL. So figure out what byte you're in, then figure out what bits of that byte. Okay, so bits 0 through 4 are where we have the condition code and function code stuff. Bits 4 through 8 are where we have our, what we'll call our opcode, which tells us which row of the table we're in, which is what we wanted for that decision of knop for halt. And then we have our next byte. So it's gonna be bits 8 through 12 overall. So the top part of that, the most significant part, is 12 through 16. And the least significant part is 8 through 12. And by the way, this is the part. Mixing these up is usually where people get confused. So if it helps, you can like draw out this reversed order. So 0 is on the right side, like that. Or you can remember to go, what byte is it in? That byte is what range? And then is it the most or least significant part of the byte? Is another way to think about it. So questions on numbering? Here. Okay. So given that, we can now write our mux to set the stat value. So here I select bits 4 through 8, which we said were our opcode. And we actually have some built-in constants because we're always building, you know. So you don't have to look up that it's 0, 1, and 0. There's a built-in constants for those values. So you don't have to look that up and can make your code cleaner. Okay, so this is our knop halt processor. And do I have a, so we can take that, so I have that CPU, and I have a an assembly file, well, I have nops.yo.ys. It turns out that because memory defaults to 0, so it defaults to halt instructions, so this contains a halt after that last nop, even if we don't write one, that we probably should have. And if I run the knop halt CPU on nops.yo, it stops and it says, ran for 6 cycles, here's the final state. Okay, this is where we'll pick up next time. We'll talk about the components we haven't talked about in HCL, like register files and memories, data memory, and how that works.